You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Potluck Food Talks. I'm here in the Bronx with Henry Obispo, also known as the Sustainable Papi. He's a community activist in many regards, everything around food, eco-gastronomy. He's around many different projects, and we're going to talk about them today.
Welcome to the Bronx.
So let's start with the project that I knew you for, which is Reborn Farms.
Oh, Reborn Farms, my gosh. Reborn Farms is really an extension of work that started really in 2014, when we launched a small farm. It's like 250 square feet on a rooftop in the South Bronx. It was really as a test, as an initiative to start growing food hyper-locally and to start connecting that to different initiatives that we would launch. And out of that really came this bigger initiative that was Bronx-wide, which was the Bronx Salad. And so we tested that out and began that there. Reborn Farms became really an idea since then, because once we launched that and we understood how everything could connect, not just to restaurants, to cultural institutions, to schools, meaning growing food hyperlocally, and how that could be transformative. Now to formalize that and to scale that, that was really the beginnings after that farm of Reborn Farms, and thinking about how we could do that while building systems and economic development with an urban farm that could be also technological, but also, you know, make use of space that would be underutilized, et cetera.
So the idea was to install farms and strategic places of the Bronx that were underutilized, and also to transform the shape of the city, so to say?
It was, you know, when you think of city life, an urban space, especially in New York City, you realize that there's space, but also the space is very expensive. You can grow food, but then seasonally, there could be a hindrance because of weather, right? Certain things just don't grow half the year. When we're thinking of open space, and because it's New York City, now you're thinking of rooftops. And so that's where we started thinking about, you know, but we have this vast resource here in New York that are rooftops that could be engaged. That was really sort of like the center of the idea in terms of developing a model. Now thinking about public housing as a way for us to solidify that model and to showcase how areas that are in need and communities that are in need, you know, need access to food are precisely the communities where these projects could be developed.
Last time we met in Spain, you brought me this hot sauces that were made with, like, in the same context of this project. So how was it? You took, like, chilies that were grown in many different parts.
So that was a project. So also in partnership with chefs, and one of the Chef King, who passed away a couple of years ago, actually, was the co-founder of that project of the Bronx Hot Sauce. And he also was a partner in the Bronx Salad development with us, specifically that the Bronx Hot Sauce took this idea of urban production when it comes to chili, specifically serrano peppers, and engaging the local community gardens to grow some of these peppers to then find a viable path for potential economic development for those people that would be working in these community gardens to grow these peppers. And so to then be able to build an added value product for the company, which is called Small Axe Peppers.
Kind of like the big vision behind this is to transform the Bronx into a food sovereign place. Like that's a great idea behind it. I like when I started getting into this project and also some project of other chefs here in New York, I walk across this concept that I never heard before, that is food apartheid. That is about systematically marginalizing communities through access to healthy food. That's kind of like the enemy in this movie, so to say.
Food apartheid is, I think, a very important term, because it frames it helps to frame better than this idea of a food desert. Because food deserts, it's a desert. There isn't food. There isn't. These are the things that are happening. But food apartheid now gives it context, which is it's a system. What allows the system to essentially become what it is, who created it, etc. And so that's the beauty of that term, which was coined by actually Karen Washington, an incredible mentor of mine. She coined that because precisely she wanted to make the distinction, it's something that is actually, it's by design. And what that is that it showcases how, because it's by design, there is a separation between access to the people and the people, and how it is institutionalized, it is systematized. And so food apartheid essentially can describe what's happened in the Bronx when it comes to food and food access. Specifically, initiatives like Reborn Farms and even the Bronx Hot Sauce, and then these other projects that we're working on are precisely to, I would say, to address that in a myriad of ways, because there isn't just one way to sort of tackle this issue because it's so vast and it's been for so long.
We've talked not only in the conversations we've had, not only about food, but also about comic books, music, and this kind of thing. I know you're pretty much into Afrofuturism. Do you think that played a role also in your vision of conceptualizing these models and this kind of things?
For sure. I mean, I exist mostly, I would say, in the future, in my mind. I mean, since childhood, I've been in wonderment, just about everything. And I think that's also what's allowed me to step out of reality a bit. To birth anything new, you have to kind of be out of the loop and be in your own world or somewhere or some other worlds.
In that future that you envision, how does the Bronx look like?
I mean, the future I envision is obviously the Bronx is transformed, and it's, you know, focused on obviously the needs in the Bronx, but the people of the Bronx are the ones creating this. The innovation is coming from here. It looks like a place of abundance. It looks like a place of just vast resources where all of these ideas have come to be and have scaled. The level of access is no longer sort of like limited in ways that we often have to fight to have. And so that's the great vision I have in a general sense. And I would say that the projects that we're working on, whether it's research that we're doing currently or developing certain components. Yeah, so whether it's the research that we're doing or the projects that we're in development of, the idea is for that vision to be a reality because of what we're preparing. And then globally, because a lot of my work has now taken me to the globe. In many ways, I would say it's tackling similar issues because, believe it or not, very similar things are happening all over the world. Very similar context, but obviously histories that sort of differ, and locations, whether it's rural, whether it's city, whether it's desert. There are these issues that are just so pronounced globally. And so I've had the great opportunity to also start working in many places around the world to address those very issues.
You told me you're in how many community boards here in the Bronx, like in the museum, what else?
Yeah, so I mean, I tried to be active in terms of like community boards.
What is exactly a community board? How does it work?
Well, these are boards that are where community members are part of these, like the institutions. So they may have, I don't know. So for example, there's a community board at Hostos College where everything is sort of discussed of what's like the vision for the universe, the college. And we can, you know, offer our opinion, but also direction. And also resources for the betterment of whatever a greater vision the university or the college has. And so it allows for the enrichment of whatever programs are going on because it's someone from the community being informed, but also informing the process. And that's really important to have because you know the community knows you, and you want the better for it. So it's important to be a part of these community boards because it allows for that. And also because you have the pulse of what's going on in the community and you can connect dots with whatever it is that you're doing to be able to now amplify and be of service in a greater way also.
So you're in the Bronx Museum of Arts, the Botanical Garden, what else?
Hostos College, as well as part of the community group at Fordham University and Lehman College as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Has this also something to do with you work with the U.S. Embassy that brought you this recent travels you were in?
Oh, no, that has nothing to do with that. Everything in life is connected, but no.
How did that happen? How is that story?
Man, this is a very powerful and incredible story because I'm going to just backtrack a whole bunch of years because I actually, when this came to be, I was very excited because as a teenager and in my adolescence in general, part of my dream, what I often dreamt about was to actually go to the Pacific, areas in the Pacific, whether it was like Vanuatu, Papua, New Guinea, and other areas, or the Cook Islands, to really be able to explore on a cultural level, but also from a sort of gastronomy level to connect all these dots. And I've been dreaming about this ever since I was that age. And from a kind of like travel point of view, travel show point of view, you know, back then. And so when I got the opportunity to be the culinary ambassador to Fiji, I was just, you know, beside myself.
That's crazy. That's like a crazy offering.
It was the most incredible thing. It really was a result of so many stars colliding, I would say. It had to do with a great friend who is out in the Pacific, Robert Oliver, who had been connecting me to the University of the South Pacific with certain projects there. And then the embassy, the U.S. Embassy in Fiji, they wanted to develop a program around food and plant-based eating and connecting it to the population, which is in many ways very much so similar to the Bronx population and what happens here. In terms of disparities. And then
let's go a little bit deeper into that. Yeah. How was the situation there? What did you found in Fiji?
Well, Fiji, I mean, it's just really one of the most incredible places on earth. I still don't have the words to describe my experience there, but very much so like what we have been addressing through our initiatives and programs here in the Bronx. What we found in Fiji, essentially, there when it comes to health and health disparities, it's major there because about 80% of the population is dealing with some type of diabetes in Fiji. Now, this is, you know, incredible tropics. Food is growing everywhere. But there are issues in terms of what people are eating, what's growing there, and what people are opting out in terms of their own ancestral foods.
Yeah, that I found that to be something very interesting. You told me about this whole colonization aftermath made the population not feel proud about their food anymore. That was like a phenomenon going on.
Well, you know, through our engagement locally, some of the things that came up was this lack of pride around their local foods, their ancestral foods, because of all of these social forces also, but also marketing forces that are marketing to villages in ways that are letting them know that, you know, that they should opt out of certain things and opt into others. And it's this sort of like very insidious processes that happen in developing countries. And, you know, because I can speak of also being from the Caribbean, the Dominican Republic, how these things can happen there in terms of connections to food and how you can disconnect, but also be marketed in a specific way that veers you away from your lineage or ancestral knowledge of food. And so in very many ways, that's what's occurred in Fiji. And so we were there to really speak and also reconnect folks in ways that it wasn't really about me, an outsider coming in and telling people what to do, but it was really offering examples of what we had done, for example, here in the Bronx and in other areas, and how, you know, the result of disconnecting from your ancestral food is diabetes. It is becoming unhealthy. It is being reliant on outside sort of sources of food. Your ancestral foods and those that will keep you healthy are surrounding you, are literally in your backyard. And so it was speaking to that and that reconnection that was just so transformative there. You know, going to talks in villages, doing like master classes around them developing dishes, specifically plant-based dishes, with everything that's going growing around them and feeling pride around that. Also speaking when it comes to like the culinary sort of world there, also speaking to people that are in more ecological pathways or like eco-friendly businesses, for them to focus on these ancestral foods and to promote themselves as such, that is the added value. That was also very powerful. So, you know, we spent over 20 days every day engaging with all parts of the society, Fijian society in different islands, listening and also having discussions in general and trying to find solutions, whether it was women's cooperatives, also developing products for added value and for economic development, and us connecting to them when it comes to that. So it was a variety of things. And as a result, I returned a very changed person and profoundly with everything I learned there, but also the connection with the people. It's just been incredible.
You think that the work you were doing there and that visit was already starting to create an impact on the community over there?
I know so, because we're receiving continuous feedback from different villages, from different groups, and the transformation that they, you know, part of that transformation was like right before our eyes, because it was very intensive in terms of like some of the workshops we did were, for example, the very last one was like a 2-day intensive workshop with mostly women that came from all over Fiji. Like Fiji's 300 islands, but they came, many of them had not even traveled. And so we summoned this group of women to come and to be able to now partake in this workshop that would allow them to now, you know, connect to the businesses that they were looking to develop, whether it was some type of ecological lodging or trekking or in their villages, all this in their villages, and to now connect them to this greater idea of food and ancestry and lineage, ways of preparing and offering this to themselves, to their villages, but also to the visitors that they were now looking to have by way of their businesses. And that was very profound. And to this day, all of these women, dozens of women, came from all over, in boats, in all types of means of transportation to get to where we were to partake in this. And the transformation, I mean, it's just so profound.
You, when we were talking earlier, you said that part of the DNA of the Bronx, or part of the reason why people come from all over the world to study what happened here. Something really important happened here a few decades ago where the community took the initiative to self-organize themselves towards a system that wasn't solving the problems they had.
I mean, it's documented, or maybe not documented enough, of, you know, when the Bronx You know, there's a coining of the Bronx is burning, and it's really in reference to the arson that took place here for about 10, 12 years, having to do with greedy landlords and building owners torching their buildings to collect insurance, to then cashing out and then leaving, which created essentially destruction, and certain populations were not able to leave. And so essentially you would think of the Bronx as a place that, you know, imploded in many ways because of all this arson and then not many resources coming to it by way of the city, the state, or the federal government, and essentially them pulling out and the Bronx being left on its own. And it was really community organizations, some of which I've been, you know, I've had the pleasure of working with, that stepped up and, you know, cleaned up the Bronx and started redeveloping the Bronx, essentially taking over where the, you know, where the federal government or the city or the state pulled out. It was really on the community level that this occurred. The Bronx is the model for community revitalization, for the community doing that on its own. Here, 138th, you have a lot of community, I would say, businesses, local businesses, a lot of Mexican, there's a vast Mexican population, also Puerto Rican and Dominican population here. So it's, you know, it's a great place to like to walk and to get your produce. There's great small mom and pop restaurants there. This area is now adjacent to another area, which is now, I would say, more gentrifying area, which is literally two blocks away, where you have more community-based and now also public housing, which is where we are. And within a block, you have a very hyper luxury by the waterfront. And all this has happened in, you know, the last 5 years. There is this sort of tale of two worlds converging here as a result of this sort of like new development.
Let's go back to what you just mentioned earlier. You were talking about the communities that you find around here, where you buy your produce. How do these communities play into the food identity of the borough?
It's a very strong food identity. The Bronx is very, very, very strong. We have representation when it comes to probably everybody from around the world. Every nationality lives here in varying numbers. And so you will find an extension of their cuisine. Obviously, the larger numbers in terms of populations and nationalities have a more sort of extensive footprint in the borough. But you can find, based on neighborhoods, you can find everything here. Everything obviously very delicious. And in many ways, the beginnings of whatever that was, a lot of it is in the Bronx, whether it's like Little Italy neighborhood here in the Bronx, which is a very authentic, I would say very autonomous region here, in existence for over 100 years with the Italian immigration.
I am.
And so you have that there in a way that doesn't exist anywhere else, really. Here in the South Bronx, you have incredible restaurants that are, you know, very much so from the Mexican community. You have Dominican restaurants, you have Puerto Rican restaurants that are sort of more abundant in the area. There are other types of like innovative restaurants that are now coming up in the more luxury area that you see there sort of like sprouting up. And then you have, when it comes to neighborhoods, you have incredible also, you know, Jamaican restaurants here. You have Ghanaian and Nigerian restaurants that are really incredible. And with that accompany their marketplaces as well. So you'll have these outlets, these marketplaces that people have to source these ethnic ingredients as well. So you'll be able to find that throughout the borough. And that's something that's very special, that we have here in the Bronx. The first little farm, like 11 years ago, was on top of this. That was the first farm that I spoke to you about. That was 250 square feet, right here.
The rooftop.
At that rooftop, yeah.
So what projects do you have in front of you in the short-term future? What are you working on?
I mean, a lot of things are in the research stage, I would say.
You're collaborating with a university in a research project?
Oh, yeah. So there's a big vision project of engaging food production, added value products. For that, we wanted to really study this on a community level, how it could affect community and also be able to impact the community from an economic point of view. And so we've partnered with Fordham University to start that research. And part of that research is us engaging with community gardens to see how certain production can happen there. And that certain production, we're looking at what could specifically be growing there that could transcend sort of like seasons and space, and really thinking of them as an aggregate and how this aggregate can now grow at scale, but grow specific things that could have added value. We're in the research right now, the research phase, and we have about another year and a half of the research before we launch a pilot for it. And I would say within a year, we'll launch a pilot, and that pilot will allow us now to look at this very interesting model, I would say, that doesn't exist in the way that we see it, but that we hope will be a pioneer and would allow for others to be inspired to also develop similar initiatives.
What about the botanical garden? What is it exactly that you're...
Well, we just ended the botanical gardens project, the African American garden. It was just the most incredible experience for the last 3 years. In partnership as the curator, Dr. Jessica Harris, the project essentially was us looking at also a very novel and way of thinking about lineage and food and connecting all the dots. And it was looking at the Bronx, obviously, because the Botanical Gardens is here. The first year we looked at the African-American experience and the migration patterns and the plants that now are associated or were associated with the African-American community.
And are these plants that were brought by the Africans that came to America?
So these are, yes. So we featured plants there that were brought from enslaved people, but also plants that were already here. But really telling the story of migration, but also enslavement and also of resilience.
And I guess by adaptation as well, right? Like also adapting to the to the available plants.
Yeah, exactly, here. Exactly. And how essentially that adaptation happened and how plants can tell that story. Yeah.
Is anything published about that?
There's stuff online, yes.
Okay.
Currently we are developing, I would say, a document with the botanical gardens where it will have even more information, but there is a lot published already. And then the second year was us focusing on the Caribbean.
Which is also an insane melting pot of...
I mean, culture. That is when you're talking about on like the hemisphere, that is where everything essentially, the world as we know it, that is the start of that, whether it's colonization or enslavement. The connection with indigenous and European indigenous and Africans.
Yeah.
That is the beginnings of all that. And so we told the story.
If you say Caribbean today, I can only think of exactly that, a mixture of indigenous Africans and Europeans and an island, basically.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is that, well, there's this greater idea of the Caribbean being a continent of islands, right? Because they are so rich and so vast that one island and the history and the impact of just one island that could be considered very small, it's equivalent to a continent.
I would also add to that the surrounding coast of continental America. For example, in Venezuela, we see ourselves as Caribbeans as well.
Right.
Because we also connect with the sea.
That's right. Yeah. And so there is a shared history along those coasts, for sure. You know, telling that story of the Caribbean, again, we were telling it through plants, over 170 plants.
Yeah, also spice, so many
all
things,
of that.
Fruits,
yeah.
Herbs.
We told the story with medicinal herbs, with fruits, with vegetables, with plants that were for, not just for medicine, but for tool making, for music making. Like when you're thinking of plants and the use and what you know of the cultures now, there is, you cannot deny how it was all shaped by people, but also how people were shaped by plants. And
Absolutely.
So we told that story there. And in this very last year, which ended in October, we told the story of the diaspora, which was now the entire hemisphere.
Yeah.
And so we told the story through over 200 plants. And those 200 plants were really, you know, connecting South America, Central America, North America, and the Caribbean, and intertwining all of this knowledge and the plant knowledge, and telling the story, this greater story of diaspora, and how we're all so connected with these plants, and we may be using them without even knowing that we're using them.
Absolutely.
And having different names for them, but also the innovation that
it's an intrinsic part of any civilization, their use of plants, absolutely.
Yeah, and so that was the Botanical Garden project.
You also mentioned in one of your farming projects, you want to get deep into herbs. What can you share about that?
Yeah, so that's part of like the research, some of the research that I was engaging you on that has to do with, there are populations that have not been well served in terms of their contributions of herbs or spices or whatever, or just plants in general. And the idea is to be able to shine a light on that. And so that's part of the research that it's ongoing for us to be able to do that and do that in a way that really serves that population well, but also allows them to reap rewards from whatever it is that we find and however it is that we look to employ this knowledge and potential project. And so, yeah, we're being very careful in terms of the research aspect to be able to get it right, because so much has not gone right when it comes to certain populations being well served. So this area is, I mean, all of this is like all the areas that I was going to show you.
Okay. Well, we're going to walk through. I'll have just like a closing question. And
yeah, we can walk through here. We can wait till like, let's pass hit this. So this was the first cannabis store in in the Bronx
since legalization.
Yeah.
Okay,
so they throw, you know, parties and stuff.
Was it?
Yeah, so you know, you can freely engage here. It's an interesting model that they have because they're connected also to formerly incarcerated people.
Okay,
and giving them opportunities in terms of like.
Well, the Mexican place we just had some tacos. You mentioned they're also engage in social enterprise model.
Yes.
Is there a lot of that going on in the Bronx?
There are a lot of very conscious, I would say, models and people wanting to develop that. But because they know, I mean, if you're on the ground, you know what the needs are. And so you want to be able to serve those needs. So you will find a lot of organizations and increasingly people wanting to be more social about their enterprising.
And just a last question, well, you as a vegan, if you would recommend top three favorite places in New York to abide?
I would say my house.
Okay.
Number one, because I mostly eat home.
I'll never forget when I tried to do a pincha tour with you in San Sebastian. And it was so impossible.
impossible, but not terribly like... impossible, but not terribly bad. Like terribly, it didn't go terribly wrong.
We found some stuff. There was, I will never forget that there was like one of the waiters as well. But why? Why does he?
Looking, I was like, why would you ask for that? Why would we even serve that? And I was just like, very apologetic, like, I'm used to it. So, you know, I can bend in terms of like, oh no, there are no options, cool. I'll opt out on this one. But you guys were being so inclusive that you really wanted me to try. But you know, everything is so delicious there and so fresh that
I remember you dripping with the almond soup.
Oh yeah.
That was really...
Oh yeah. I was taken aback by that soup because it was just so delicious. Like, it was just so simple. But so I'm like...
Ajo blanco, which is basically an almond gazpacho.
Yeah. I've had gazpacho here, obviously, in other places, but it wasn't like that.
No, that one is like a very special.
That was on another level.
Yeah.
And so I was very much so like, I wanted to try all of these things and whatever we could find. So I'm very grateful that you decided to bring me along on that, even though you knew it was probably not going to be.
I talk about that a lot, you know. I do that story.
It was a very funny and learning experience.
So top one, your house.
So my house, I really love. Also, there's this place that opened up downtown, Ras Plant Base. It's more like an Ethiopian inspired place. I mean, I go to a lot of places that are like could be very.
Is this where you have this? Like this giant pancakes on the table?
Yeah, no, that's more like more traditional Ethiopian. This is more like bowls and like smaller plates.
Okay.
They've kind of like revamped, I would say Ethiopian inspired, because you have some of that, but with just, it's with other types of complex ingredients, for lack of a better word. And so I really like that because there's a level of like innovation, but also keeping it very culturally relevant, which is, you know, I also love Ethiopian food, but then there are other components to it that keep it very interesting. I think they have like two or three locations and they just opened one downtown. So I really like them. I would say for my third, there's this Mexican spot we just went to a Mexican place. And I have a plant-based option there, which is, I think they make the best tacos.
So you were talking about the tortillas?
Yeah, so, you know, instead of just saying of a vegan restaurant, I want to prop up a local restaurant that I love, and I've worked with them on many initiatives, restaurant initiatives, but food initiatives, along with other restaurants around, and, you know, I really think that these mom-and-pop restaurants are the true heroes in our community, so... and the true stakeholders that should get the mention. So even though they're not a vegan place, they have vegan options. They've accommodated many of our initiatives that are plant-based also in their restaurants to be able to promote health and plant-based eating. And I would say that those are, in Mexico Sina, they are the best tacos in New York City. I say that because I believe it, and I have them often there, but also because the recipes are, you know, the owner's great-grandmother and grandmother, and so he's brought them from Mexico here and keeps them still to tradition. And so I have the Tacos Mexicocina, which are very specific to their sort of house tacos. They're not the regular tacos. They're very specific, and I usually have the mushroom ones with them. They're just the most delicious. So I would say that those are the three places that I would recommend. But if you wanted to come to my house, you have to, you know, get on the list.
That's it for this week's episode of Potluck Food Talks. If you like what we're doing, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also find us on Instagram and TikTok as Potluck Food Talks. The show airs every Monday.